haven't found a chair, find one. So, good evening. I'd like to welcome thank everyone for joining us today for this exciting event. For those who I have not met, my name is E.C. Schroeder, and I have the honor to serve as the director of the Beinecke Library. This afternoon, I'm very pleased to welcome you to the inaugural reading of the Mark Strand Memorial Reading Series. This evening's events are important for rare book and manuscript libraries in the 21st century. No longer can a library just collect and preserve its collections. It also needs to make them available through exhibits, teaching, and research. And tonight's reading builds on our fabulous poetry collections and is key towards making the Beinecke a national center for the living art of poetry. What makes the Beinecke unique is how central it is in the life of Yale. Last week, this is great, the university chose to announce our new athletic director here at the Beinecke, complete with Hampson Dan, a marching band, but the highlight of the event, at least to me, was that the new athletic director quoted Mark Strand at the end by saying, "The future is always beginning now." Tonight we host the first reading in the Mark Strand Memorial Reading Series, which honors the poet and visual artist Mark Strand, Yale class of 1959. He was the author of numerous books and poetry collections, including Blizzard of One, which was the winner of the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. He also wrote Dark Harbor, The Story of Our Lives, and Reasons for Moving, among many others. His many honors include Yale's Bollingen Prize for American Poetry, the Wallace Stevens Award, the Bobbitt Prize, and fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Academy of American Poets, the Mark Arthur Foundation, and the Ingram Merrill Foundation. Shortly before he passed away in 2014, Strand gave a reading here at the Beinecke, a recording of which can be found on our website. The enthusiastic response that night makes tonight's occasion even more fitting. Everything here, collections, programs, and the building itself, exists only because of the amazing support we've received over the decades. Dr. Jeffrey Ravitch, class of 1973, joins the tradition of generosity, moving us in a new and exciting direction. Dr. Ravitch established tonight's reading series in honor of Mark Strand, his friend and fellow Yale graduate. As an undergraduate, double majoring in English and molecular biophysics and biochemistry, Dr. Ravitch worked with the Beinecke collections and developed, this is something that I could never imagine doing at the same time. Dr. Ravitch worked with the Beinecke collections and developed a lifelong passion for 20th century American poetry. Throughout his career in medical research, he has maintained his interest in American poetry and developed an extraordinary collection in this field, which we are now thrilled to have here at the Beinecke. Our current exhibit on display upstairs and downstairs, entitled The Art of Collaboration, highlights how artists, writers, and others work together. An evening like this is also an exercise in collaboration. And I'd particularly like to thank Mike Moran for his amazing work in publicity and communication, Carrie Sankum, our exhibits coordinator, Basie Gitlin, our director of development for both the Beinecke and the University Library, Melissa Barton, co-curator of the American Literature Collection with Nancy Kuhl, and the amazing Jen Castellan, our events coordinator. Each of these individuals have helped to make this evening possible. And I'd like to encourage you, after tonight's readings, to view the small pop-up exhibit, which is at the back behind here, which contains a photograph, print, and books from Jeff's collection, and includes a first edition of Blizzard of One with a lovely inscription from Mark Strand to Jeff and his wife, Wendy. And I also particularly enjoyed the photograph of Mark and Jeff just hanging out and reading. I only wish I had the opportunity to do that. At this time, I'd like to introduce Nancy Kuhl, curator of poetry for the American Literature Collection and the maestro of Jeff in creating this series and making tonight possible. And she will introduce our afternoon's guest.
Thank you, EC. I echo your thanks to our collaborators for today's event and to your welcome of our special guests, Jeff Ravitch and Wendy Joseph. It's been my great pleasure over the last year to get to know Jeff and Wendy. I'm inspired by Jeff's love of and enthusiasm for poetry, and it has been so much fun working with him to plan the Strand Memorial Reading Series, and more specifically, today's event. When Jeff suggested that we invite poet, scholar, and translator Rosanna Warren to deliver the inaugural event in this series, I was delighted. I can think of no one more appropriate to read at the Beinecke Library, a place Rosanna knows very well, and in honor of her friend and fellow poet Mark Strand. In her tribute to Strand, published in the fall of 2015, just a year after his death, Warren wrote, quote, "Mark's only citizenship was in the Republic of the Imagination. It is a realm flooded with moonlight, at times lush, at times vacant." Rosanna Warren is herself a citizen of this republic, a poet as fascinated by our shared cultural mythologies as she is by the movement of light, quote, "robing and disrobing an image upon shaken waters." She is, in the words of J.D. McClatchy, a poet of, quote, "radiant eloquence, and one whose poems, poet Jane Hirschfield notes, are, quote, "saturated with intellect." Rosanna Warren is the author of numerous books of poetry, works of criticism and translation, and she's been involved with a wide range of editorial projects. She's received grants and awards from the Academy of American Arts and Letters, the Lila Wallace Foundation, the Guggenheim Foundation, and the Academy of American Poets, among other institutions. Warren is presently the Hannah Holborn Gray Distinguished Service Professor in the Committee on Social Thought at the University of Chicago. She is a member of the Yale College class of 1976, and she is also a member of the Beinecke Library family. She is the daughter of legendary writers Robert Penn Warren and Eleanor Clark, both of whose rich literary archives are here in the Yale Collection of American Literature. In Rosanna Warren's Republic of the Imagination, elemental forces shape and are shaped by human emotion, vision, and thought. The result is a sensory brilliance, an intensity that can just be held in the mind. The light, she writes in a poem named for the French painter Pierre Bonnard, doesn't smash us in the face or tilt us backward out of our lives. Please join me in welcoming Rosanna Warren.
Well, thank you, Nancy, and thank you to the Beinecke Library, and thank you to Jeff for endowing this beautiful tribute to our friend Mark Strand. I first heard Mark read here at Yale when I was 19 and a sophomore, and he had published, I think, just one book then, and I'll never forget that I was completely floored. I was flabbergasted by this new kind of language, a new kind of envisioning. And after that, we were friends for what was the rest of Mark's life. So I have deep gratitude to all of you who made this happen and invited me back here to what is, in a sense, home ground. I'm going to start by reading a poem of Mark Strand's. It's called The History of Poetry. It's from his book, The Continuous Life. And I think you'll see why I'm reading it. It's a little parable about how an older art gives birth to a younger art and how this keeps on going. The History of Poetry. Our masters are gone, and if they returned, who among us would hear them? Who would know the bodily sound of heaven or the heavenly sound of the body, endless and vanishing, that tuned our days before the wheeling stars were stripped of power? The answer is, none of us here. And what does it mean if we see the moon-glazed mountains and the town with its silent doors and water towers and feel like raising our voices just a little? Or sometime during late autumn, when the evening flowers a moment over the western range, and we imagine angels rushing down the air's cold steps to wish us well, if we have lost our will, and do nothing but doze, half hearing the sighs of this or that breeze drift aimlessly over the failed farms and wasted gardens. These days, when we waken, everything shines with the same blue light that filled our sleep moments before. So we do nothing but count the trees, the clouds, the few birds left, Then we decide that we shouldn't be hard on ourselves, that the past was no better than now, for hasn't the enemy always existed? And wasn't the church of the world already in ruins? So thank you, Mark. I'm going to start by taking a swig. If I were W.H. Auden, this would be gin. But I'm not, and it's not. I promise. I'm going to read a few poems from this book, Ghost in a Red Hat, but mostly I'm reading new poems from a new manuscript, which I think is called Graffiti. Anyway, let's see. And I should just, perhaps, it's not a trigger warning, but just mention that the tones of these poems are all very different one from another. Mediterranean. When she disappeared on the path ahead of me, I leaned against a twisted oak. All I saw was evening light where she had been, gold dust light, where a moment before and 38 years before that, my substantial mother strode before me in straw hat, bathing suit, and loose flapping shirt. Every summer afternoon, her knapsack light across her back, her step in sandals firm on the stony path. As we returned from the beach, and I mulled small rebellions and observed the dwarfish cork trees with their pocky bark, the wind-rustled oaks with arms akimbo, while shafts of sea light stabbed down between the trunks. There was something I wanted to say at the age of 12, some question she hadn't answered. And yesterday, so clearly seeing her pace before me, it rose again to the tip of my tongue. And the mystery was not that she walked there 10 years after her death, but that she vanished and let twilight take her place. I grew up partly in France, and so this book has some French poems in it, and here's one. It's called Mistral One. Mistral is that fierce wind that roars down through France from the north, and when it hits the Mediterranean, it slams all the shutters and sinks sailboats and is mythologically supposed to make people crazy. Mistral One. Two donkeys graze in a meadow of wild golden buttons. Scents of eucalyptus and honeysuckle mingle in morning air. Distantly, down at the shore, rise the voices of children discovering things. Childhood burned with a long wick. I have returned here to examine the ashes. The gulls lament some tedious age-old woe as they skim off toward the harbor, while the sun bores into and into the petaled whorls of the golden flowers like radiation, the whole meadow bristling with a heat that destroys and sustains. This doesn't matter to the donkeys, who munch on regardless. Over my garden table, the sun casts a shadow lattice of ilex leaves, an open weave that trembles across books and notebook pages, rearranging the words. Just as well. They were not the best words. I am willing to be rewritten, and let the printed poems of others be rewritten as well, and let them steep in the bitter smell of eucalyptus, which is said to heal. And may the dark fire far away, charring my friend's hurt cells, complete its work. Let him grow into his longer story, the good one, the one in which sunlight runs in the veins with the force of summer, and children find some new thing and shout at the sea. Now, this next poem you may find incomprehensible. You're meant to. It's about sick schizophrenia, which is generally, I think, feels incomprehensible to those who are outside of it, perhaps when you're inside of it too. Fear. I follow, trying to pick up scraps of the poem as you drop them, you hide them, but they rustle. I pry them out from under cushions, under the bed. I pluck them like beaded curtain strings from the whoosh of water in the shower where you pretend to bathe when you are no one. No one is afraid of water. No one carves the soap so it won't touch his skin. It's the throb and splatter of water that drums the color out of each day. Good day, hello, hollow spider fingers, sunken eyes, anti-soap for antimatter. You look out from a burned out star, light years away, still emitting photons with that appealing, deep, affectionate dog's look of frightful understanding, a magic cloak of smell. No one will touch. No one is safe. No one plays golf with interstellar swings, so the ball never lands. TV keeps reciting the right spell day and night. The door is sealed shut with masking tape. Daylight strips human skin like acid. As long as the danger lived outside me, I couldn't write it. Wants to crawl through the keyhole, slide over the windowsill. It breathes in the shirts hanging in the closet. It rots the cheese. It lives in my breath. It hides in the pages of the poems of Paul Verlaine like a smear of shit. It has signed a contract in ink, squeezed from stars. You are the gentlest prayer. You see where the shadow falls across each eye. Of course, of curse, song of all our days. You were empty, so I drew a shrine, and it stayed empty. There's a elegiac sequence in this book for my friend, the writer Deborah Tall, who died of breast cancer some few years ago, and it has an epigraph from one of her poems. Aftermath, dawn, the moment it was over. Deborah Tall. It was that last euphoric summer between one chemo and another, when you looked out your kitchen window and saw the doe standing at the edge of your lawn where the thicket gathers, autumn olive, buckthorn, forsythia, dogwood. And when you stepped outside, the doe stayed still and looked in your eyes, you thought, with a companionable, complicit question, and didn't run. You were lightheaded. The doe lowered her nose to shove at the small bundle at her feet, folded up like an awkward deck chair, till then invisible in its hollow of grass. She had just given birth. The fawn couldn't stand, but raised its too large head to gaze at you. You were, as you said, already more or less posthumous. You took each other in, one of you before, the other beyond fear. Two creatures, side effects on one another, headed in opposite directions. And here's for a great change in tone. This poem, Porta Portese, is the title refers to the flea market in Rome, but as I tell my Italian friends, it's really about Wall Street. And I wrote it in the summer before 2008, and you may remember there was a slight disturbance in the fall of 2008, and we're having a slight disturbance now, so I thought I would read this poem. When I read this shortly after 2008, and I'm certainly no economist, a banker who was in the audience came up to me later and said, "You don't understand anything about money." I said, "Maybe I understand more than you think." Porta Portese. If it once gleamed, if it ticked, if it buzzed, if it oiled eternal youth, if it whispered on an old tape with the sexual lure of infinite cash, if it said, "I am your private castle and you are a queen," if it lit 1,000 bulbs, if it shaved 1,000 hairs, if it declared, "God loves you," if it promised to cure hair lips, eczema, scabies, rage, if it clipped the hangnails, if it delivered proverbs, if it hugged the ass it's laid out on a collapsible table or mat on asphalt, money will change hands, money will change us all, change gypsies, professors, Nigerian whores, limping children, drugged babies, iPodded teens, Somali refugees, artists in drag, illegal Albanians, cruising Poles. We said, "One world." We said, "Isn't my money good enough for you? Switchblade, switch banks, the Cloaca Maxima accepts all currencies. The Tiber leaks yellow between its legs. Venereal, venerable, duty-free, luxurious, silken, rippling, classical waves, sold and soldered, solved, reflected here." I get a little steamed up. So I think I'll read some of the new poems now. I've been writing I think the heart of the new book is a sequence I think I'm calling by the Chaucerian title of A Dream of Fair Women, and it's sort of poems about remarkable women, some of them remarkably horrible, some not. And here's a poem to one of my favorite poets, the 16th century English poet Mary Sidney, the Countess of Pembroke, the Sidney Psalms, the majority translated by her, some by her brother, Sir Philip Sidney, I think it's one of the most radical books in English, and it's got more different verse forms than Thomas Hardy, which is saying a lot. So anyway, I urge you all to go read Mary Sidney. And she, like for many women in the Renaissance, her form of writing often took the form of translation. So she also translated Petrarch, and there's some Petrarch in here, and quotations from Mary Sidney, which I think you'll hear. And she translated, one of the works of Petrarch she translated is called The Triumph of Death. The Triumph of Death to Mary Sidney. "In your lace ruff, you resemble a giant snowflake or a spider web pearled with dew. What poets you catch in your symmetries at your long table at Wilton. What wits Spencer, Fulk-Greville, Drayton pitch into the roasted piglet, stewed apples, carp. If you roused God up, he knocked you back on your heels, lady. O God, why hast thou thus repulsed and scattered us? Through the high windows at Wilton seethe rumors of battle, Philip's pussing thigh, death in the lowlands, mother wrong, daughter strife, stalk the cities. Still, you keep house with grammar. You salt the psalms for long preserving. As smoke in wind, as wax at fire doth waste, the unjust dissolve. Your stanzas stay, still sting the tongue. Dawn finds you kneeling on stone, calling again the bleak God you believe will answer you. You mix medicines, you write in invisible ink, but time trumps fame, which undoes death, which masters chastity and love, which leaves eternity, your master wrote. Master of all, and like your lace, Your lines shine not pale, but whitely and more whitely pure than snow on windless hill that flaking falls, as one whom labor did to rest allure. Translate us too, rough line by line, into your crystalline, severe design. One of the other women in the series is the painter Gwen John, who was also a lover and model for Rodin. She was British, but spent her whole adult life painting and living in France. And this is a poem, well, it's self-explanatory. It's called Rodin Commands. Gwen John and Hilda Floden, his assistant, make love for his viewing. When you will do the unthinkable, because the other wills it, as peony petals droop and cringe, and the whole blossom crumples sidewise, open to fingers, coaxing it apart, we could call this a loss of form, a velvet shivering. She, upon his instruction, lies down with Hilda, taking leave of her own body, for truly, whose are those limbs entwined, and whose the convulsion trilling down even to stiffening toes? It's his brush that arcs, his aquarelle pleasuring these collapsible blooms. The paper drips and runs, small flames shudder in the coal stove. The bouquet sags. His greatest gift will have been to prove once and for all that the person craving is not. And another one of my ladies is Coco Chanel, who really was, I think, quite a monster, but a great artist. It has an epigraph from her, Chanel. A garment should be logical, Coco Chanel. Yes, I made the perfume. Yes, I am an orphan. Light my cigarette. Just so. The perfect profile intaglioed in air. Now let the hems down. Now we slash the collar. And when a man enters, always make him pay. Always a stray prince around before the casino closes. This century tilts. I'm good at sphinxing. Elegance excludes. I exclude milk, waste, tears, uterus. Do I remember the lard-colored orphanage halls? No, I refuse. Place a Coromandel screen in front of the car wreck and your world war, my demi-monde. We live in an age with no interiors, and his blood scrawled the pavement by the crumpled car. Embellishment gives way to line and ease of motion, a Bugatti flair. Wealth assuming the proportion of catastrophe. And if the other was a German officer? I'm on my knees with a corona of pins bristling from my lips. It's not adoration. It's revenge. Let's see. And here's a very different sort of lady, woman. Marianne Faithfull. I assume that even the young people in this room know that she's a really interesting singer who was for a while sang in the 60s with a little girl crooning voice and was the consort of Mick Jagger and then had a period of really down and outness with drugs and alcohol and then came back with a wrecked and transformed and really, I think, artful, amazing voice. And it has an epigraph from her. Away. The whole trick of this thing is to get out of your own light, Marianne Faithfull. She said she sang very close to the mic to change the space. And I changed the space by striding down the Boulevard Raspail at dusk in tight jeans, until an Algerian engineer plucked the pen from my back pocket. As if you're inside my head and you're hearing the song from in there. He came from the desert. I came from green suburbs. We understood nothing of one another over glasses of metallic red wine. I was playing girl. He played man. Several plots were afoot, all misfiring. One had to do with my skimpy black shirt and light hair, his broad shoulders and hunger after months on an oil rig. Another was untranslatable. Apollinaire burned his fingers on June's smoldering lyre, but I had lost my pen. The engineer read only construction manuals. His room was dim and narrow, and no, the story didn't slide that way, though there are many ways to throw oneself away. One singer did it by living by a broken wall until she shredded her voice, but still she offered each song, she said, like an Appalachian artifact, like trash along the riverbank, chafing at the quay, plastic bottles, a torn shirt, fractured dolls, through which the current chortles an intimate tune. So I'm skipping out of that sequence now. Here's a more recent poem of French landscape. The only reason I need to mention that it's French, it's because there's a recent, I guess in the last 10, 15 years, a new kind of group of homeless people in France. They're called in the newspapers SDF, sans domicile fixe, which is sociological jargon for the homeless. And this particular group, they're not the old clochards, and they're not technically the Roma people. They're Europeans, and they move kind of in a tribal way and wear a kind of slightly militaristic clothing and often have big dogs with them. I hope you'll feel from the poem that I fundamentally think some way we're all homeless on this planet. Sans domicile fixe. Clouds like boulders. Boulders like petrified clouds that rolled down and stalled in the meadow. That was yesterday. Now we're in the centripetal apartment with peonies aging in two vases, pink and cream petals, frizzling into crepe. Mirrors multiply the years. I see you seeing me in the gilt-framed oval by the desk. I see us both in the window, reflected in the closet door glass. My eye corners crease. Flecks of dark chocolate streak the inner spines of all the books. Words are drugs. Love is a drug. While Europe contracts into dark burgundy upholstery and cushions. Deep in the French-English dictionary, three asterisks mark extreme vulgarity. How long can we stay here? Outside, the new homeless twist dreadlocks and pace their mastiffs. Tattoos bulge on their forearms. Paper wrappers and crushed cans clot the gutter. Sun leaps off the roof tiles, a brisk sea wind. In the mountains, those small purple flowers with pods and curling tendrils. Now you tell me, were vetch. And just winding up here. Shelf. A human skull among the bibelots. Dust to dust, it all evens out on the shelf under a veil of gray. There was a think in that cavity once. I have forgotten whole years of my life. In those eye sockets once, surprise and fear. You picked it up in a field in Turkey. A small head, a child, a youth, Who knows how he, she died? Though we can imagine, yes, horribly imagine, and so forget. Better look at the Kenyan statuette of a woman carrying a pot on her head, or the soapstone dove from Japan, or twisted driftwood. Why go looking for sorrow? Yet we look, we hunt. You probe the boiled mackerel head for every mite of sustenance, brain, the tiny white golf balls of eyes, the fatty ribbon along the jaw, an augury in each bite. I don't want to remember how much pain I've caused. Centuries of war we store in our craniums. But in that skull, now crouched on the shelf, no echo, no prayer, only air, a relic of air. And I'll just conclude with these two. The line. It's hard to see them through the lacing of forest shadows, the old crimson blazes on tree trunks marking the line. Sometimes the tree has fallen. Sometimes the paint has worn away and could be confused with lichen. I clamber down banks, trample underbrush, pause squinting between boughs, seeking the next mark. The pines have scaly, lacerated bark. Yellow birches wring crabbed hands and shudder. I played here as a child. Now I stumble from boulder to moss hollow. Who was that girl in raggedy summer jeans and smudged t-shirt scrambling up granite ledges? I think I see her slip like a coyote into older dark. She had unevenly cropped hair, grime in her fingernails. She crouched on a rock midstream and peered for trout, umber quaver in the bronze-flecked flow. And once, in shadow, kissed another girl on the mouth, both of them wanting to know how a boy's kiss would taste. It tasted of fear, moist, tremulous, hovering on a brink of territory imagined but unmarked, whose wind came muttering through branches, smelling of balsam and leaf mold, of creatures loosened back into ground. And here's the last one. Cotillion photo. I didn't have a cotillion myself. I hardly didn't know what they were, but this poem was inspired by seeing some photographs of some other people's cotillions. Cotillion photo. These young women will last forever, posed like greyhounds, trapped in the silver crust of the frame. You can't tell one from another. The breed is so pure. They will never run. Each one aloft on a frozen wave of white cotillion lace to resemble marriage, to resemble fate. I remember July sun pouring down in a prickly meadow and a garter snake skin laid out like fairy lingerie on a stone wall. This was Connecticut. There would be a stone wall. Crickets were scraping marrow from the day. I was young. I'd been alone for weeks. I painted the meadow morning and afternoon, trying to capture the crackling sound with my brush. I was reading Oedipus Rex. I understood neither the snakeskin nor the play. Your life is one long night, said Oedipus to the prophet, Oedipus, who saw nothing. Oak trees rustled in drought. In saffron grass, small creatures skittered. There came a day when I said to myself, I should prefer to sleep. Small planets tasted dry and bitter on my tongue. And 2 days later, I woke, alone in the creaking barn at dusk, not knowing what day, what month, what year, but feeling the hall of Earth rolling on its way. It is not your fate that I should be your ruin, the prophet said. I moved my arms, my legs, I unclenched my hands, and stood up, dizzy, from the cot. What was to come would come in its own good time, outside the frame. The moon was rising above the hill. A shy wind gathered force, and trees in their black silhouettes linked arms. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rosanna, for that wonderful reading. Please join us for a reception on the other side of the mezzanine. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.